Was that it? Were you pissed off because you thought you were the prettier one? You thought you should get all the attention? I just lost it then. I knew that if she didn't shut up, I was going to hit her, so I said it. I hated him, you stupid bitch! I hated him because he took her from me! Everyone went quiet for a bit. Then Sean said, "He took her from you. How did he do that, Lena?" I couldn't help it. I was just so fucking tired. And it was obvious that they were going to find out now anyway, now that Josh had gone and opened his big mouth. But most of all, I was just too tired to lie anymore. So I sat there in our kitchen, and I betrayed her. I'd promised her, after we argued, after she swore to me that they'd split up and she wasn't seeing him any longer. She made me swear that no matter what happened, no matter what, I would never tell anyone about them. We went to the pool together for the first time in ages. We sat under the trees where no one could see us, and she cried and held my hand. "I know you think it's wrong," she said, "that I shouldn't have been with him. I get that. But I loved him, Leanie. I still do. He was everything to me. I can't have him hurt. I just can't. I couldn't bear it. Please don't do anything that would hurt him. Please, Leanie, keep this secret for me. It's not about him. I know you hate him. Do it for me." And I tried. I really did. Even when my mum came to my room and told me that they'd found her in the water. Even when Louise came to the house half mad with grief. Even when that piece of shit gave a statement to the local papers about what a great student she was. How much she was loved and admired by students and teachers alike. Even when he came up to me at my mother's funeral and offered his condolences, I bit my fucking tongue. But I'd been biting and biting and biting for months now. And if I didn't stop, I was going to bite clean through. I was going to choke on it. So I told them. Yes, Katie and Mark Henderson had a relationship. It started in the autumn. It ended in March or April. It started up again in late May, I thought, but not for long. She ended the relationship. No, I didn't have proof. They were really careful, I told them. No emails, no texts, no messenger, nothing electronic. It was a rule with them. They were strict about it.
They were, or he was? Erin asked.
I glared at her.
Well, I never discussed it with him, did I? That's what she told me. It was their rule.
When did you first find out about this, Lena? Erin asked.
You need to go right back to the beginning.
No, actually, I don't think she does, Julia said suddenly. She was standing over by the door. I'd forgotten she was even in the room.
I think Lena is very tired and should be left alone for now. We can come by and do this at the police station tomorrow, or you can come back here, but that's enough for today.
I actually wanted to hug her. For the first time since I'd met her, I felt like Julia was on my side. Erin was about to protest, but Sean said,
"Yeah, you're right."
And he got up, and they all marched out of the kitchen and into the hallway. I followed them. When they were at the door, I said to them, "Do you realize what this will do to her mum and dad when they find out?" Erin turned round to face me.
"Well, at least they'll have a reason why," she said.
"No, they won't. They won't have a reason," I said. "There was no reason to do what she did. Look, you're proving it right now. By being here, you're proving that she did it for nothing."
"What do you mean, Lena?"
They were all stood there, staring at me, expectant.
"She didn't do it because he broke her heart or because she felt guilty or anything like that. She did it to protect him. She thought that someone had found out. She thought he was going to be reported and that he'd be in the papers. She thought there would be a trial and he would be convicted and he would go to prison as a sex offender. She thought he'd be beaten or raped or whatever it is that happens to men like that inside. So she decided to get rid of the evidence, I said. I was starting to cry by then, and Julia stepped out in front of me and put her arms around me. She was going, shh, Lena, it's all right, shh. But it wasn't all right. That's what she was doing, I said. Don't you understand? She was getting rid of the evidence.
Friday the 21st of August. Erin. The cottage by the river, the one I saw when I went running, is to be my new home. In the short term, at least. Just until we sort out this business with Henderson. It was Sean who suggested it. He overheard me telling Callie, the DC, that I'd almost run the car off the road this morning, I'd been so knackered. And he said, well, we can't have that. You should stay in town. You could use the ward's cottage. It's just upriver, and it's empty. It's not luxurious, but it won't cost you anything. I'll get you the keys this afternoon. As he left, Callie grinned at me. The ward's cottage, eh? Watch out for Mad Annie. I'm sorry? That place by the river that Patrick Townsend uses as his fishing cabin. It's known as the Ward's Cottage. As in Anne Ward? She's one of the women. They say, she said, lowering her voice to a whisper, that if you look hard enough you can still see the blood on the walls. I must have looked nonplussed. I had no idea what she was talking about, because she smiled and said, it's just a story, one of the old ones, one of those ancient Beckford stories. I wasn't paying a lot of attention to century-old Beckford stories. I had fresher ones to concern myself with. Henderson hadn't been answering his phone, and we'd taken the decision to leave him alone until his return. If the Katie Whittaker story was true, and if he got wind that we knew about it, he might not come back at all. In the meantime, Sean had asked me to question his wife, who, as head teacher at the school, is Henderson's boss.
I'm certain she never had the faintest suspicion about Mark Henderson, he said. I believe she thinks rather highly of him, but someone needs to talk to her, and it obviously can't be me.
He told me she'd be at the school and that she'd be expecting me. If she was expecting me, she certainly didn't act like it. I found her in her office, on her hands and knees, her cheek pressed to the grey carpet as she craned her head to look under a bookcase. I coughed politely, and she jerked her head up, alarmed.
Mrs. Townsend, I said.
I'm D.S. Morgan, Erin.
Oh, she said. Yes.
She blushed, putting a hand to her neck.
Lost an earring, she said.
Both, by the looks of it, I said.
She made an odd sort of huffing noise and indicated that I should sit.
She tugged at the hem of her blouse and smoothed her grey trousers before sitting herself. If I'd been asked to picture the D.I.'s wife, I'd have imagined someone quite different. Attractive, well-dressed, probably sporty, a marathon runner, a triathlete. Helen wore clothes more suited to a woman 20 years her senior. She was pale and her limbs soft, like someone who rarely went out or saw the sun.
You wanted to speak to me about Mark Henderson, she said, frowning slightly at a pile of papers in front of her.
No small talk then, no preamble, straight down to business. Perhaps that's what the DI likes about her.
Yes, I said. You've heard the allegations made by Josh Whittaker and Lena Abbott, I take it?
She nodded, her thin lips disappearing as she pressed them together. My husband told me yesterday. It was, I can assure you, the first I'd heard of such a thing. I opened my mouth to say something, but she continued. I recruited Mark Henderson 2 years ago. He came with excellent references, and his results so far have been encouraging. She shuffled the pages in front of her. I have specifics if you need them. I shook my head, and again she started speaking before I could ask the next question. Katie Whittaker was conscientious and hard-working. I have her grades here. There was, admittedly, some slippage last spring, but it was short-term. She'd improved again by the time... By the time she'd... She passed her hand over her eyes. By the summer. She sank a little into her chair.
So you had no suspicions? There were no rumours?
She cocked her head to one side. Oh, I didn't say anything about rumours. Detective, Morgan, the rumours that fly around the average secondary school would make your hair curl. I'm sure, she said, a twitch around her mouth, that if you put your mind to it, you might be able to imagine the sort of things they say and write and tweet about me and Ms. Mitchell, the PE teacher. She paused. Have you met Mark Henderson?
I have.
So you understand, then. He's young, good-looking. The girls, it is always the girls, say all sorts of things about him. All sorts. But you have to learn to cut through the noise, and I believed I had done that. I still believe I'd done that. Again I wanted to speak, and again she pressed ahead. I have to tell you, she said, raising her voice, that I am deeply suspicious about these allegations. Deeply suspicious, because of their source and because of the timing. I understand that the allegation came first from Josh Whittaker, but I'd be surprised if Lena Abbott isn't behind all this. Josh dotes on her. If Lena decided that she wanted to deflect attention away from her own wrongdoing, purchasing illegal drugs for her friend, for example, I'm sure she could have persuaded Josh to come up with this story.
Mrs. Townsend.
Another thing I should mention, she continued, permitting no interruption, is that there was some history between Lena Abbott and Mark Henderson.
History?
A couple of things. First, that her behaviour could at times be inappropriate.
In what way?
She flirts, not just with Mark either. It seems she's been taught that it's the best way to get what she wants. Many of the girls do it, but in Lena's case, Mark seemed to feel that it went too far. She made remarks. Touched him.
Touched him?
On the arm, nothing outrageous. She stood too close, as the song goes. I had to speak to her about it.
She seemed to flinch slightly at the memory.
She was reprimanded, though of course she didn't take it seriously. I think she said something along the lines of, "He wishes."
I laughed at that, and she frowned at me.
It really isn't a laughing matter, Detective. These things can be terribly damaging.
Yes, of course, I know. I'm sorry.
Yes, well...
She pursed her lips again, every inch the schoolmarm.
Her mother didn't take it seriously either, which is hardly surprising.
She coloured, an angry flush of red appearing at her neck, her voice rising.
Hardly surprising at all. All that flirting, the endless batting of lashes and tossing of hair, that insistent, tiresome expression of sexual availability. Where do you imagine Lena learned that?
She took a deep breath and exhaled, pushing her hair from her eyes.
The second thing, she said, calmer now, more measured, was an incident in the spring. Not flirting this time, but aggression.
Mark had to send Lena out of his class because she was being aggressive and quite abusive, using foul language during a discussion about a text they were studying.
She glanced down at her notes.
Lolita, I believe it was.
She raised an eyebrow.
Well, that's interesting, I said. Quite. It might even suggest where she got the idea for these accusations,
Helen said, which wasn't what I'd been thinking at all. In the evening, I drove out to my temporary cottage. It looked much lonelier with dusk looming, the bright birches behind it now ghostly, the chuckle of the river not so much cheerful as menacing.
The banks of the river and the hillside opposite were deserted.
No one to hear you scream.
When I'd come past on my run, I'd seen a peaceful idyll. Now, I was thinking more along the lines of the desolate cabin of 100 horror films.
I unlocked the door and took a quick look around, trying, as I did, not to look for blood on the walls. But the place was tidy, with the astringent smell of some sort of citrusy cleaning product. The fireplace swept, a pile of chopped wood neatly arranged at its side. There wasn't much to it. It was more of a cabin than a cottage, really. Just two rooms, a living room with a galley kitchen leading off it, and a bedroom with a small double bed, a pile of clean sheets, and a blanket folded on the mattress.
I opened the windows and the door to get rid of the artificial lemon smell, opened one of the beers I'd bought at the co-op on the way down, and sat on the front step, watching the bracken on the hill opposite turn bronze to gold with the sinking sun. As the shadows lengthened, I felt solitude morph into loneliness, and I reached for my phone, not certain who I was going to call. Then I realized, of course, no signal. I hauled myself to my feet and wandered about, waving the phone in the air. Nothing, nothing, nothing. Until I walked right down to the river's edge, where a couple of bars appeared. I stood there a while, the water just about lapping my toes, watching the black river run past, quick and shallow. I kept thinking I could hear someone laughing, but it was just the water, sliding nimbly over the rocks. I took ages to fall asleep, and when I woke suddenly, feverishly hot, it was to inky darkness, the kind of deep black that makes it impossible to see a hand in front of your face. Something had woken me, I felt sure. A sound? Yes, a cough. I reached for my phone, knocking it off the little bedside table, the clatter as it fell to the floor startlingly loud in the silence. I scrabbled around for it, gripped suddenly by fear, sure that if I turned on the light it would reveal someone standing there in the room. In the trees behind the cottage I could hear an owl hooting. And then again, someone coughing. My heart was beating too fast. I was stupidly afraid to pull back the curtain above my bed just in case there was a face on the other side of the glass, looking back at me. Whose face was I expecting? Anne Ward's? Her husband's? Ridiculous. Muttering reassurances to myself, I turned on the light and flung back the curtains. Nothing and no one, obviously. I slipped out of bed, pulled on tracksuit bottoms and a sweatshirt, and went through to the kitchen. I considered making a cup of tea, but thought better of it when I discovered a half-empty bottle of Talisker in the kitchen cupboard. I poured myself a couple of fingers' worth and drank it quickly. I slipped on my trainers, put my phone in my pocket, grabbed a torch from the counter, and unlocked the front door. The batteries in the torch must have been low. The beam was weak, reaching no more than 6 or 7 feet in front of me. Beyond that was perfect obscurity. I angled the torch downwards to light up the ground in front of my feet and walked out into the night. The grass was heavy with dew. Within a few steps, my trainers and tracksuit bottoms were soaked through. I walked slowly all the way around the cottage, watching the torchlight dancing off the silvery bark of the beech trees, a cohort of pale ghosts. The air felt soft and cool, and there was a kiss of rain in the breeze. I heard the owl again, and the low chatter of the river, and the rhythmic croak of a toad. I finished my circuit of the cottage and started walking towards the riverbank. Then the croaking suddenly stopped, and again I heard that coughing sound. It wasn't nearby at all. It was coming from the hillside, somewhere across the river, and it didn't sound so much like a cough this time either. More of a bleat. A sheep. Feeling somewhat sheepish myself, I went back into the cottage, poured myself another shot of whiskey, and grabbed Nell Abbott's manuscript from my bag. I curled up in the armchair in the living room and began to read.
The Drowning Pool, Anne Ward, 1920. It was already in the house. It was there. There was nothing to fear outside. The danger was within. It was waiting. It had been waiting there all along, ever since the day he came home. In the end, though, for Anne, it wasn't the fear. It was the guilt. It was the knowledge, cold and hard as a pebble picked from the stream, of what she'd wished for, the dream she had allowed herself at night when the real nightmare of her life became too much. The nightmare was him, lying beside her in bed, or sitting by the fire with his boots on, glass in hand. The nightmare was when she caught him watching her, and saw the disgust in his face, as though she were physically repugnant. It wasn't just her. She knew that. It was all women, all children, old men, every man who hadn't joined the fight. Still, it hurt to see, to feel. Stronger and more clearly than anything she'd ever felt in her life. How much he hated her. She couldn't say she didn't deserve it, though, could she? The nightmare was real. It was living in her house. But it was the dream that haunted her, that she allowed herself to long for. In the dream, she was alone in the house. It was the summer of 1915, and he'd only just gone away. In the dream, it would be evening, the light just dipping over the hillside across the river, darkness gathering in the corners of the house. And there'd be a knock at the door. There would be a man waiting, uniformed, and he'd hand her a telegram, and she'd know then that her husband was never coming back. When she daydreamed about it, she didn't really mind how it happened. She didn't care if he died a hero, saving a friend, or as a coward fleeing the enemy. She didn't care so long as he was dead. It would have been easier for her. That was the truth of it, wasn't it? So why shouldn't he hate her? If he died out there, she would have mourned him. People would have felt sorry for her, her mam, her friends, his brothers. Were there any left? They would have helped out, rallied round, and she would have got through it. She'd have grieved for him for a long time, but it would have come to an end. She would be 19, 20, 21, and she'd have a life ahead of her. He was right to hate her. 3 years, close to 3 years he was out there, drowning in shit in the blood of men whose cigarettes he'd lit, and now she wished he'd never come back. She cursed the day the telegram didn't come. She had loved him since she was 15 years old, couldn't remember what life felt like before he came along. He'd been 18 when the war started and 19 when he went. And he came back older every time, not by months, but by years, decades, centuries. The first time, he'd still been himself, though. He'd cried in the night, shaken like a man with a fever. He told her he couldn't go back, he was too afraid. The night before he was due to return, she found him by the river and dragged him home. She should never have done that. She should have let him go then. It had been selfish of her to stop him. Now look what she had wrought. The second time he came home, he didn't cry. He was silent, shuttered, barely looked at her, except slyly, sighed on from under hooded lids, and never when they were in bed. He turned her over and didn't stop even when she begged, even when she bled. He hated her then, hated her already. She didn't see it at first, but when she told him how sad she felt about how they were treating those girls up in prison, about the conscientious objectors and all that, he slapped her face and spat at her and called her a traitorous fucking whore. The third time he came home, he wasn't there at all. And she knew that he'd never come back now. There was nothing left of the man he had once been. And she couldn't leave. She couldn't go and fall in love with someone else because he was all there ever was for her. And now he was gone. Gone. But he still sat by the fire with his boots on and drank and drank and looked at her as if she was the enemy. And she wished he was dead. What sort of life is that? Anne wished there could have been some other way. She wished she'd known the secrets that the other women knew. But Libby Seaton was long dead now, and she had taken them with her. Anne knew some things, of course, most of the women from the village did. They knew which mushrooms to pick and which to leave. They were warned about the beautiful lady, Belladonna, told never, ever to touch it. She knew where it grew in the woods. But she knew what it did, too, and she didn't want him to go like that. He was afraid all the time. She could see it, could read it on him whenever she sneaked a glance. His eyes always on the door, the way he looked out at dusk, trying to see beyond the tree line. He was afraid, and he was waiting for something to come. And all the time, he was looking in the wrong place. Because the enemy wasn't out there. It had already come inside, into his home. It sat at his hearth. She didn't want him to feel afraid. She didn't want him to see the shadow fall across him, so she waited until he was sleeping, sitting in his chair with his boots on, the bottle empty at his side. She was quiet and she was quick. She put the blade against the back of his neck and drove it in hard so that he barely woke, and he was gone for good. Better that way. There was a hell of a mess, though. Of course there was. So afterwards she went to the river to wash her hands. Sunday, the 23rd of August. Patrick. The dream Patrick had of his wife was always the same. It was night, and she was in the water. He left Sean on the bank and dived in. He swam and swam, but somehow, as soon as he was close enough to reach out for her, she drifted further away, and he had to swim again. In the dream, the pool was wider than in real life. It wasn't a pool, it was a lake, it was an ocean. He seemed to swim forever, and only when he was so exhausted that he was sure he'd go under himself did he eventually manage to grab hold of her, to pull her towards him. As he did, her body rotated slowly in the water, her face turned towards his, and through her broken, bloodied mouth, she laughed. It was always the same. Only last night, when the body rolled in the water towards him, the face was Helen's. He woke with a terrible fright, his heart pounding fit to burst. He sat up in bed with his palm flat against his chest, not wanting to acknowledge his own fear or how it was mixed with a deep sense of shame. He pulled back his curtains and waited for the sky to lighten, black to grey, before going next door to Helen's room. He entered quietly, gently lifting the stool from beside the dressing table and placing it at her bedside. He sat. Her face was turned away from him, just as it had been in the dream, and he fought the urge to put his arm on her shoulder, to shake her awake, to make sure that her mouth was not full of blood and broken teeth. When she finally stirred, rolling over slowly, she started when she saw him, jerking her head violently backwards and banging it on the wall behind her as she did. "Patrick! What's wrong? Is it Sean?" He shook his head.
"No. Nothing's wrong."
"Then,
did I leave some things in your car?" he asked her. "The other day, I took some rubbish from the cottage and I meant to throw it away, but then the cat. I was distracted, and I believe I left it there. Did I?"
She swallowed and nodded, her eyes black, the pupils squeezing the irises to pale brown slivers.
"Yes, from the cottage. You took those things from the cottage?"
She frowned, as if she was trying to figure something out.
"Yes, from the cottage. What did you do with them? What did you do with the bag?"
She sat up. "I threw it away," she said. "It was rubbish, wasn't it? It looked like rubbish."
"Yes, just rubbish."
Her eyes darted away and then returned to his.
"Dad, do you think it had started up again?"
She sighed.
"Him and her. Do you think..."
Patrick leaned forward and smoothed the hair back from her forehead.
"Well, I'm not sure. Maybe. I think maybe it had. But it's over now, isn't it?"
He tried to get to his feet, but he found that his legs were weak, and he had to haul himself up with one hand on the bedside table. He could feel her watching him, and he felt ashamed.
"Would you like some tea?"
he asked her.
"I'll make it," she said, pushing back the covers. "No, no. Stay where you are. I'll do it."
At the door, he turned back to her.
"You got rid of it, that rubbish,"
he said again. Helen nodded. Slowly, his limbs wooden and his chest tight, he made his way down the stairs and into the kitchen. He filled the kettle and sat at the table, his heart heavy in his chest. He had never known Helen to lie to him before, but he'd been fairly certain, back there, that she had. Perhaps he should have been angry with her, but mostly he was angry with Sean, because it was his mistake that had led them here. Helen shouldn't even be in this house. She should be at home, in her husband's bed. And he should not have been placed in this position, the ignominious position of cleaning up his son's mess, the indelicate position of sleeping in the room next door to his daughter-in-law. The skin on his forearm itched beneath his bandage, and he scratched at it absent-mindedly. And yet, if he was honest, and he always tried to be, who was he to criticize his son? He remembered what it was to be a young man, rendered helpless by biology. He had chosen badly for himself, and he still felt the shame of it. He chose a beauty, a weak, selfish beauty, a woman who lacked self-control in almost every regard. An insatiable woman. She set herself on a self-destructive path, and the only thing that surprised him now, when he thought about it, was that it took as long as it did. Patrick knew what Lauren had never understood, just how many times she had come perilously close to losing her life. He heard footfall on the stairs and turned. Helen stood in the doorway, still in her pajamas, her feet bare.
"Dad, are you all right?"
He got to his feet, prepared to make the tea, but she put her hand on his shoulder.
"Sit down. I'll do it."
He'd chosen badly once, but not the second time. Because Helen, the daughter of a colleague, quiet and plain and hard-working, was his choice. He saw at once that she would be steady and loving and faithful. Sean had to be persuaded. He had fallen in love with a woman he'd met as a trainee, but Patrick knew that wouldn't last, and when it went on longer than it should have, he put an end to it. Now he watched Helen and knew that he had chosen well for his son. Helen was straightforward, modest, intelligent, wholly uninterested in the kind of celebrity trivia and gossip that seemed to consume most women. She didn't waste time with television or novels. She worked hard and didn't complain. She was easy company, quick to smile. "Here you go," she was smiling at him now as she handed him his tea. "Oh," she inhaled sharply through her teeth. "That doesn't look good." She was looking at his arm, where he'd scratched it and torn away the bandage. The skin underneath was red and swollen, the wound dark. She fetched warm water, soap, antiseptic, fresh bandages. She cleaned the wound and bound his arm again, and when she was finished, he leaned forward and kissed her mouth. "Dad," she said, and pushed him gently away. "I'm sorry," he said. "I'm sorry." And the shame returned, overwhelming now, and the anger too. Women brought him low, Lauren first and then Jeannie, and on. But not Helen, surely not Helen. And yet she'd lied to him that morning. He'd seen it in her face, her candid face, unused to deception, and he'd shuddered. He thought again of the dream, Lauren turning in the water, history repeating itself, only the women getting worse. Nicky. Jeannie said it was about time someone did something about all this.
"Easy for you to say," Nicky retorted. "And you've changed your tune, haven't you? Used to be that I was supposed to keep my mouth shut for me own protection. Now you're telling me to throw caution to the wind?"
Jeannie was silent on that point.
"Well, in any case, I've tried. You know I've tried. I've been pointing in the right direction. I left the sister a message, didn't I? Not my fault if no one listens to me. Oh, too subtle, am I? Too subtle? You want me to go around shooting my mouth off? Look where talking got you."
They'd been arguing about it all night.
"It isn't my fault. You can't say it's my fault. I never meant to get Nell Abbott into any trouble. I told her what I knew, that's all, like you'd been telling me to. I can't win with you. I really can't. I don't know why I even bother."
Jeannie was getting on her nerves. She just would not shut up. And the worst of it, well, not the worst of it, the worst of it was getting no bloody sleep at all, but the second worst of it was that she was probably right. Nicky had known it all along, from that first morning sitting at her window when she felt it. Another one. Another swimmer. She'd thought it then. She'd even thought about talking to Sean Townsend. But she'd done well to hold her tongue there. She'd seen how he reacted when she mentioned his mother, that snarl of anger, the kindly mask slipping. He was his father's son after all.
"So who, then? Who, old girl? Who am I supposed to talk to? Not the policewoman. Don't even suggest it. They're all the same. She'll go straight to her boss, won't she?"
"Not the policewoman, so who? Nell's sister?" Nothing about the sister inspired Nicky with confidence. The girl, though, she was different. "She's just a child," Jeannie said, but Nicky replied,
"So what? She's got more get-up-and-go in her little finger than half the people in this town.
Yes, she would talk to the girl. She just wasn't sure what she was going to say yet. Nicky still had Nell's pages, the ones they'd worked on together. She could show the girl that. They were typed, not handwritten, but surely Lena would recognize her mother's words, her tone. Of course, they didn't spell things out the way Nicky had thought they ought to. It was part of the reason they'd fallen out, artistic differences. Nell had gone off in a huff and said that if Nicky couldn't tell the truth, then they were wasting their time. But really, what did she know about the truth? They were all just telling stories.
Are you still here? Jeannie asked.
I thought you were going to talk to the girl. And Nicky replied,
All right, keep your hair on. I will. I'll do it later. I'll do it when I'm ready.
Sometimes she wished Jeannie would shut up, and sometimes she wished more than anything that she were here, in the room, sitting by the window with her, watching. They should have grown old together, getting on each other's nerves properly, instead of bickering over the airwaves like they had to now. Nicky wished that when she pictured Jeannie, she didn't see her the way she was the last time she came to this flat. It had been just a couple of days before Jeannie had left Beckford for good, and she was pale with shock and shaking with fear. She had come to tell Nicky that Patrick Townsend had been to see her. He told her that if she kept on talking like she had been, if she kept on asking questions, if she continued to try to ruin his reputation, he would see to it that she was hurt.
"Not by me," he said. "I wouldn't bloody touch you. I'll get someone else to do the dirty work. And not just the one fella either. I'll make sure there's a few, and that each of them takes his turn.
You know I know people, don't you, Jean?
You don't doubt that I know people who would do things like that, do you, girl?"
Jeannie had stood right there in that room and made Nicky promise, made her swear she'd leave it alone.
"There isn't anything we can do now. I should never have said anything to you."
"But the boy," Nicky said. "What about the boy?"
Jeannie wiped the tears from her eyes.
I know. It makes me sick to think of it, but we'll just have to leave him there. You have to be quiet, say nothing, because Patrick will do for me, Nix, and he'll do for you, too. He's not messing around."
Jeannie left a couple of days later. She never came back.
Jules. Tell me, honestly, wasn't there some part of you that liked it? I woke with your voice in my head. It was mid-afternoon. I can't sleep at night. This house rocks like a boat, and the sound of the water is deafening. In the day, it's not so bad somehow. At any rate, I must have fallen asleep, because I woke with your voice in my head asking, wasn't there some part of you that liked it? Liked or enjoyed? Or was it wanted? I can't remember now. I only remember taking my hand from yours and raising it to hit you, and the look on your face, uncomprehending. I dragged myself across the hall to the bathroom and turned on the shower. I was too exhausted to undress, so I just sat there while the room got steamier and steamier. Then I turned off the water and went to the sink and splashed my face. When I looked up, I saw, appearing in the condensation, two letters traced on the surface of the mirror, an L and an S. I got such a fright that I cried out. I heard Lena's door open, and then she was pounding on the bathroom door.
What? What's happening? Julia?
I opened the door to her, furious. What are you doing? I demanded. What are you trying to do to me? I pointed back at the mirror. What? She looked annoyed. What? You know very well, Lena. I don't know what you think you're trying to do, but... She turned her back on me and started to walk away.
Christ, you're such a freak!
I stood there staring at the letters for a while. I wasn't imagining things. They were definitely there. L.S. It was the sort of thing you used to do all the time. Leave me ghostly messages on the mirror, or draw tiny pentagrams in red nail polish on the back of my door. You left things to scare me. You loved to freak me out, and you must have told her that. You must have, and now she was doing it too. Why L.S.? Why Libby Seaton? Why fixate on her? Libby was an innocent, a young woman dragged to the water by men who hated women, who heaped blame on them for things that they themselves had done. But Lena thought you went there of your own volition, so why Libby? Why L.S.? Wrapped in a towel, I padded across the hallway and into your bedroom. It seemed undisturbed, but there was a smell in the air, something sweet, not your perfume, another. Something cloying, heavy with the scent of overblown roses. The drawer next to your bed was closed, and when I pulled it open, everything was as it had been, with one exception. The lighter, the one on which you'd had Libby's initials engraved, was gone. Someone had been in the room. Someone had taken it. I went back to the bathroom and splashed my face again and rubbed the letters from the mirror. And as I did, I saw you standing behind me, that exact same look on your face, uncomprehending. I whirled around and Lena raised her hands as though in self-defense.
Jesus, Julia, chill! What is going on with you?
I shook my head.
You just what?
She rolled her eyes. I need some air. But on the front step, I almost cried out again, because there were women, two of them, at the gate, dressed in black and bent over, entangled in some way. One of them looked up at me. It was Louise Whittaker, the mother of the girl who had died. She dragged herself away from the other woman, speaking angrily as she did.
Leave me! Leave me alone! Don't you come near me!
The other one waved a hand at her, or at me, I couldn't be sure. Then she turned and slowly hobbled off along the lane.
Bloody nutcase! Louise spat as she approached the house. She's a menace, that sage woman. Don't engage with her, I'm telling you. Don't let her through your door. She's a liar and a con artist. All she wants is money.
She paused to catch her breath, frowning at me.
Well, you look about as awful as I feel.
I opened my mouth and shut it again.
Is your niece at home?
I showed her into the house. I'll just get her for you, I said. But Louise was already at the foot of the staircase, calling Lena's name. Then she went into the kitchen and sat down at the table to wait. After a moment, Lena appeared. Her typical expression, that combination of haughtiness and boredom so reminiscent of you, was gone. She greeted Louise meekly, although I'm not even sure if Louise noticed, because her eye was trained elsewhere, on the river outside, or some place beyond. Lena sat down at the table, raising her hands to wind her hair into a knot at the nape of her neck. She lifted her chin slightly, as though she were preparing herself for something, an interview, an interrogation. I may as well have been invisible for all the attention they paid me, but I remained in the room. I stood by the counter, not relaxed, but on the balls of my feet, in case I needed to intervene. Louise blinked, slowly, and her gaze finally came to rest on Lena, who held it for a second before looking down at the table.
I'm sorry, Mrs. Whittaker. I'm really sorry.
Louise said nothing. Tears coursed down the lines of her face, in runnels carved from months of unrelenting grief.
I'm so sorry, Lena repeated.
She was crying too now, letting her hair down again, twisting it through her fingers like a little girl.
I wonder if you'll ever know, Louise said at last.
How it feels to realise that you didn't know your own child.
She took a deep, shuddering breath.
I have all her things. Her clothes, her books, her music, the pictures she treasured. I know her friends and the people she admired. I know what she loved. But that wasn't her. Because I didn't know who she loved. She had a life, a whole life, that I didn't know about. The most important part of her, I didn't know.
Lena tried to speak, but Louise went on.
The thing is, Lena, that you could have helped me. You could have told me about it. You could have told me when you first found out. You could have come to me and told me that my daughter had got herself caught up in something, something she couldn't control, something you knew, you must have known, would end up being harmful to her. But I couldn't.
Again, Lena tried to say something, and again Louise wouldn't let her.
Even if you were blind enough or stupid enough or careless enough not to see how much trouble she was in, you could still have helped me. You could have come to me after she died and said, this isn't something you did or didn't do. This isn't your fault. This isn't your husband's fault. You could have stopped us from driving ourselves mad. But you didn't. You chose not to. All that time, you said nothing. All this time, you... And worse. Even worse than that. You let him...
Her voice rose and then disappeared into the air, like smoke.
Get away with it.
Lena finished the sentence. She was no longer crying. And although her voice rose, it was strong, not weak.
Yes, I did. And it made me sick. It made me fucking sick, but I did it for her. Everything I have done, I did for Katie. Don't you say her name to me,
Louise hissed.
Don't you dare. Katie, Katie, Katie!
Lena was half on her feet, leaning forward, her face inches from Louise's nose.
Mrs. Whittaker, she collapsed back into her seat. I loved her. You know how much I loved her. I did what she wanted me to do. I did what she asked of me.
It wasn't your decision, Lena, to keep something as important as that from me, her mother.
No, it wasn't my decision. It was hers. I know you think you have the right to know everything, but you don't. She wasn't a child. She wasn't a little girl. She was my little girl.
Louise's voice was a wail, an ululation. I realised I was gripping the counter, that I too was about to cry. Lena spoke again, her voice softer now, supplicating.
Katie made a choice. She made a decision, and I honoured it.
More gently still, as though knowing she was moving onto dangerous ground.
And I'm not the only one. Josh did, too.
Louise drew back her hand and hit Lena once very hard across the face. The smack resounded, echoing off the walls. I leaped forward and grabbed Louise's arm.
No! I shouted. That's enough! That's enough!
I tried to pull her to her feet.
You need to go! Leave her!
Lena snapped. The left side of her face was an angry red, but her expression was calm.
Stay out of it, Julia. She can hit me if she wants. She can scratch my eyes out, pull my hair. She can do whatever she wants to me. What does it matter now?
Louise's mouth was open. I could smell her sour breath. I let go.
Josh didn't say anything because of you, she said, wiping spittle from her lips. Because you told him not to say anything.
No, Mrs. Whittaker. Lena's tone was perfectly even as she placed the back of her right hand against her cheek to soothe it. That isn't true. Josh kept his mouth shut because of Katie.
because she asked him to. And then later on, because he wanted to protect you and his dad. He thought that it would hurt you too much to know that she'd been...
She shook her head.
He's young. He thought...
Don't tell me what my son thought, Louise said, what he was trying to do. Just don't.
She raised her hand to her throat. A reflex. No, not a reflex. She was gripping the bluebird that hung on her chain between thumb and forefinger.
This, she said, a hiss, not a word. It wasn't from you, was it?
Lena hesitated for a moment before shaking her head.
It was from him, wasn't it? He gave it to her.
Louise pushed her chair back, scraping its feet across the tiles. She pulled herself upright and, with a vicious tug, ripped the chain from her neck, slamming it down on the table in front of Lena.
He gave that thing to her, and you let me hang it around my neck.
Lena closed her eyes for a moment, shaking her head again. The meek, apologetic girl who'd crept into the kitchen a few minutes ago was gone, and in her stead sat someone different, someone older, the adult to Louise's desperate, intemperate child. All at once, I had the clearest memory of you, a little younger than Lena is now, one of the few memories I have of you sticking up for me. There was a teacher at my school who had accused me of taking something that didn't belong to me, and I remembered you admonishing her. You were clear-sighted and cool, and you didn't raise your voice when you told her how wrong she was to make accusations without evidence, and she was cowed by you. I remembered how proud I was of you then, and I had the same feeling here, the same sensation of heat in my chest. Louise began to speak again, her voice very low.
"Explain this to me, then," she said, sitting back down, "since you know so much, since you understand so much. If Katie loved that man, and if he loved her back, then why? Why did she do what she did? What did he do to her, to drive her to that?"
Lena turned her gaze to me. She looked afraid, I think, or maybe just resigned. I couldn't quite read her expression. She watched me for a second before closing her eyes, squeezing tears out of them. When she spoke again, her voice was higher, tighter than before.
"He didn't drive her to that. It wasn't him," she sighed. "Katie and I argued," she said. "I wanted her to stop it, to stop seeing him. I didn't think it was right. I thought she was going to get into trouble. I thought..."
She shook her head.
"I just didn't want her to see him any more."
A flash of understanding crossed Louise's face. She understood, in that moment, as did I. "You threatened her," I said. "With exposure."
"Yes,"
Lena said, barely audible.
"I did."
Louise left without a word. Lena sat motionless, staring at the river outside the window, not crying and not speaking. I had nothing to say to her, no way of reaching her. I recognized in her something I know I used to have too. Something maybe everyone has at that age. Some essential unknowability. I thought how odd it was that parents believe they know their children, understand their children. Do they not remember what it was like to be 18 or 15 or 12? Perhaps having children makes you forget being one. I remember you at 17 and me at 13. And I'm certain that our parents had no idea who we were. "I lied to her," Lena's voice broke my train of thought. She hadn't moved. She was still watching the water.
"Lied to who?
To Katie?" She shook her head. "To Louise? What did you lie about?" There's no point in telling her the truth, Lena said. Not now. She may as well blame me. At least I'm around. She needs somewhere to put all that hate.
What do you mean?